Welcome to the Legal Nurse Podcast, where you'll get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside the legal nurse consulting business. They'll share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with over 30 years' experience. So join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's your host, Pat Iyer.
Hi, this is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast, and today we're going to be talking about an interesting topic that gives rise to some lawsuits, particularly in the long-term care industry, and that is when one resident starts attacking or hitting on another resident in a long-term care facility. I have with me an expert who is very familiar with a long-term care environment. She has worked for more than 25 years in the geriatric setting in the capacity of product development, operations, and clinical roles, both in the local community as well as regional and corporate levels, spanning several states across the United States. In 2009, Gina formed GD Solutions, LLC, which is a clinical consulting firm. She works with nursing homes, senior living facilities, and also provides expert witnesses to attorneys. She has multiple nursing home and senior living case reviews that she's completed, and she helps attorneys and clinicians and owners and operators understand the nuances of risk and exposure in the long-term care industry. And she's also developed an interdisciplinary team concept comprised of medical, nursing, therapy, wound, social work, MDS, which is minimum data set, and administrative subcontractors when other experts are required. Gina and I have talked about her business, and I've watched and helped her with her business growth over the years, and she has developed quite an expertise in this area. So I think you'll enjoy hearing her today as we talk about one of the specific and special problems for long-term care. Gina, welcome to the show. Thank you for being with me today.
Thank you, Pat.
Let's talk about why this is a timely topic.
Pat, it is. Well, thank you for having me on your recording today. I'm very honored that you invited me. It's a timely topic because so many of the demographics of our nursing home environment and assisted living are changing. While we're used to seeing older women that are frail and in their 80s coming into these environments, it is now changing dramatically. We're seeing more mental health. We're seeing more veterans. We're seeing more, as a result of that, we're seeing more men coming into these settings. When families just don't know what else to do or where to turn to. And as a result of that, coming into environments that aren't like their home, they're no longer in their community, they lose their network of friends for the most part until they make new ones. Can be a very stressful time. Think about any moves you made in your life from high school to college or being single to being married. I remember when I got married, I think the most difficult change for me was sharing drawers with my husband. I wanted to have my own chest of drawers the way that I had already always had it. And just that alone really set me off for having the mail come in his name and not mine. So if you can imagine, excuse me for a minute, if you can imagine heightening that to, you know, the level of somebody's world being completely turned upside down, you can see how there's a perfect recipe for resident-on-resident altercations.
And I'm thinking, as you were talking about the population, the mix in long-term care of frail elderly people and perhaps younger mentally ill men or stronger men, how that would give rise to some of the uneasy mix of people. Tell us about the the factors that lead to these altercations, other than what I just mentioned in terms of mixing two very diverse populations?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I wanted to do is, when I teach courses on this topic, I like to talk about the brain a little bit. And I'm going to just give you a very, very quick version of how the brain works. And when I think of the brain, I think of the outside of the brain being like a football helmet. And it's there to serve our functions that make us more sophisticated and make us human versus our animal friends. And then as you go further down in the brain, that frontal, or those cortexes that are kind of like your helmet, protect the things that are much more vital to your staying alive, like your ability to breathe or your blood pressure control. So when you look at the brain and you look at diseases that happen to the brain that cause aggression, many of our listeners who are nurses have certainly heard before of the four different cortexes of the brain: the frontal, the parietal, the temporal, and the occipital parts of the brain. And so I just kind of want to touch on those a little bit. So your frontal lobe, where you start to see a lot of behavioral changes in people, is that area of the brain, like I tell my daughter or my niece who I cycle with, who crosses roads earlier than she should, and I'm always fearful she's going to get hit by a car. I tell her that when you turn 21, you will have a more developed frontal cortex and you won't do high-risk behaviors. Or when you go to college, maybe you won't enjoy yourself so much that when you fall down, you won't have a facial injury like some of my family members have had, because they've had a little bit too good a time. That's called the area of the frontal lobe that controls your spontaneity and your motor function and your judgment and your initiation. That part of the brain doesn't develop until you are in your 20s. So when you have a disease process going on in there, like a tumor or a stroke that causes some sort of obstruction to that area of the brain, you start to see loss of judgment happen, or impulsivity, which is what we see a lot of in our setting. The temporal lobe is kind of like the earmuffs. That's how I refer to it. And that controls your hearing and your auditory and your speech, because they all kind of work together. And that's why speech therapists are so involved in the cognitive aspects of functional decline when it happens. So again, when you have people that have some sort of disease or functional loss to that area of the brain, to the earmuffs, I call it, you're going to have somebody that may have expressive aphasia or receptive aphasia. And in a nutshell, what that means is, I can't understand you, or I can't express the way I feel. Therefore, it's frustrating to me and I might act out. You can imagine going through your day and not being able to say what you think. Imagine how frustrating that must be. Or if you're in a room with somebody that can't do those things and they annoy you, you could see how that could create what I call that perfect storm for one resident to act out on another. The next part of the brain is the parietal lobe. And the parietal lobe, that involves your sensation, your cognition. It's how you integrate sensory input and visual systems. So I'll give you an example of that. I remember when I was a young nurse, I had a resident with a brain tumor, and another nurse and I were fixing her hair about 4:30 in the morning because we couldn't stand the way it looked. She was of African-American descent, and we were doing a horrible job fixing her hair and making it look nice. And we started to laugh at our inability to be able to do this. And the resident completely misinterpreted what we were doing. And she ended up completely losing it, if you will, emotionally, and looked at me as that perpetrator, that person that was making fun of her. And that was a real turning point for me about maintaining your professionalism in front of a patient, because they can misinterpret your good deeds, if you will. Your occipital lobe, which is in the back of your brain, that controls your visual processing in your visual cortex. So when we do sensitivity training in our setting, sometimes we'll fog up glasses with Vaseline, or we'll put a patch over a person's eye, and we'll have somebody walk in front of them to the side of them that they can't see out of, or stand in front of them, but instead of bending down to get eye level with them, they're talking at waist length. So the person, all they see is basically their shirt and not the whole being or not the eyes. That can also be an issue if you have a visual deficit of some sort. If you walk by a resident and you say, hey, it's time to go to dinner, or you mispronounce their name, and all they hear is a voice and not a human being taking the time to stand in front of them and get down where their eyes are and see them. So again, understanding the brain is extremely important. There's also an area of the brain that I just want to touch on for a minute, and that's called the limbic system. And the limbic system, again, sits under the helmet, and whoever our creator is created it that way so that these areas would be protected by the cortex, as I just touched on. And some of these areas are called your hypothalamus, your hippocampal area, and your amygdala. Your amygdala is something I just want to touch on for a minute. Your amygdala controls anger and your rage. So when you're reviewing a record as a nurse and you see that they have damage to the limbic system or this area of the brain, it should make you think a little bit about this person's emotional center and whether or not you need to investigate the record more before you take them in as one of your residents. Further on down into the brain, we go into the lower part of the brain that controls those primary functions that we don't have to think about, like blinking and blood pressure, your cardiac system. You don't have to think about your heart rate, right? It just happens until you cease to exist. Your vasomotor aspects of your body, like when you get frightened and you have a vasovagal and you lose consciousness right away. That's your body taking over for whatever reason. So if you have a lesion or something to that area of the brain, it might cause physical manifestations to occur, like all of a sudden the person's there and then they drop to the ground, or they have respiratory issues, or in many circumstances, they never even make it to a long-term care setting. They're in an ICU on a ventilator. So I touch on these things so that people can understand that when you see behavioral things going on, the difference between a good nurse and a great nurse, or a good social worker and a great social worker, or anybody else on the IDT, is to understand, before I judge this person, what's happening with them, what diseases do they have, could there be a disease that hasn't even been diagnosed that I think might be going on, and I need to get a doctor to make that determination, what meds have they had changed? Because maybe it was something there that's going on. Do they have something called delirium, which is not dementia? It's a resolvable condition, usually from an infection. In most cases in our settings, it's a urinary tract infection or pneumonia that's causing this behavioral change. And I refer to that as critical thinking. Do we have a nurse, an IDT, that can be good critical thinkers and try to figure out in a fun detective way what's going on, rather than rolling their eyes and saying, I can't believe Joe Blow's giving us a hard time again. When's the shift over?
And that's a great review for us to think about the different parts of the brain that can be damaged. I've seen a number of people with traumatic brain injuries who've had frontal lobe damage, and they have problems with impulsivity, which could certainly be a factor in an altercation. If a legal nurse consultant is getting involved in a case, it's usually because somebody has assaulted somebody else. Before I continue, listen to this. Nursing home cases are specialized. This area of litigation has its own rules, regulations, and language. Who better to learn from than an attorney who has spent his time litigating assisted living and nursing home cases? Attorney Sean Doolin has developed expertise in representing the victims of nursing home and assisted living malpractice. He shares his lessons learned and provides specific information that you can use to review a case involving a nursing home. Sean gives you his attorney insights on how care is improved by lawsuits, how nursing homes try to prevent falls, which cases are difficult to win, the role of the ombudsman, the types of medical malpractice claims that occur from care in assisted living facilities versus nursing homes, how to look for signs of quality care in a nursing home, and where to look on the internet for a rating of a nursing home. This program is called Reducing the Risks of Nursing Home Care. Purchase this program's transcript at this link, lnc.tips/NHC. Let me give you that full link, http://lnc.tips/NHC, and use the code LISTENED to get a 25% discount on the price.
Correct.
I can remember cases that I reviewed in which the resident had dementia and was telling people after he was found with bruises all over his body, he said, "A man came in the dark and hit me." And the defense of this case was, oh, he was on Coumadin, and therefore the bruises on his body came from him hitting his arms against the side rails. So give us some guidance in that situation. How do we as legal nurse consultants try to tease out and figure out what happened?
Well, that comes with being a very good investigator, and I'm going to go through some of the F tags in a minute. But, you know, it's a data point. So when you see someone with bruises on their arms, what's the first thing you do? It's pretty much what you said. You review the medical record to try to see, did they start a new anticoagulant? And that includes some of the newer medications today, like Xarelto, or were they on aspirin? Or did they hit the side rail? And if that's the case, and that's what you determine by the area of the markings on the body, then you only do that through the investigative process. Mm-hmm. So that while you collect that data, anyone involved in the care of that resident has to be interviewed. And I'm going to share with you some interview techniques that I've actually used. But you have to do a structured interview. That means that their roommate, their roommate's family or friends, residents in front of them, meaning across the hall, residents to the side of them. That means certainly all the staff that worked on the floor. And I generally like to look at about a 3-day span. And it's generally the same staff. But I'll give you an example. We had a resident's family member that heard a slap across the hall. And this was in a very affluent area in Maryland. And then we heard a resident start to cry. Well, he was just appalled. After an investigation of him, the resident, his mother, all of the staff involved, the aide who fled the country and did not come back, interestingly, we learned that this relationship had been going on for 10 years, where this aide had slapped this resident, and it was kind of I can't even explain the relationship because it was so bizarre to me, but it was kind of the dynamic that they got into. And, you know, the good news was we had a family member step up right away. And then we also stepped up right away and did the investigation that we needed to do to conclude where we, you know, ended up with. But these sorts of things can happen in any facility. So it's very important that you respond to it appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
Because resident on resident, resident on staff, and resident on visitor, altercations can occur. So it doesn't have to be just between the resident and the resident themselves. I've had situations where visitors have been a little too verbal or physical with residents, family members or otherwise. And I've had certainly staff to resident and resident to staff. So another important factor is understanding how your state regulations guide you to report. I was just in one state working there this summer, and in that particular state, they did not require us to report when a resident was physical with a staff member. In other states, it doesn't matter who the altercation is with, they want you to report it. So that was a learning piece for me.
Yes. And I think we're probably, or many people on this call are familiar with the case in Arizona with an employee who impregnated a woman who was in a long-term care facility long-term. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not an altercation, but certainly sexual activity between staff members and residents is a whole nother topic that just came to mind, and he was identified because of DNA testing.
Yes, unfortunately, while rare, thankfully, those situations can happen. By the same token, if you have two residents that are fully alert and they want to engage in a consensual relationship as part of our resident rights and the dignity of two individuals that are that need the services of a long-term care environment, you need to care plan those things. And my biggest advice to people is have open-ended communication with your families and make sure that everyone is on board. Social services certainly guides that process and the physician so that you can allow people to be human beings in these settings and at the same time protect their safety. And that can be a little bit of a slippery slope. But again, my feeling is with open communication and honesty and a show of compassion, you know, these things can be, these waters can be waded.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned earlier about federal regulations, and I know that the legal nurse consultants listening to us would want some background in terms of where they would look in the federal regulations for the information that addresses the altercations that we're talking about. And we'll leave the sexual contact aside, but focus on the physical violence or maybe verbal violence that can occur and result in lawsuits. Can you give us some details about that?
Sure. So in preparation for our call this afternoon, I did pull some regulations, and I'll tell you, if you can see it behind me, you'll see something we call a watermelon book.
Yes.
And that is long-term care survey. That is, I believe that book was actually created in 1987. It goes back to the Reagan administration when the first set of COMAR regs were written, and those regulations have been drastically revised in the last 3 years. 2017 was when all of the regulations changed in the way that we conduct our abuse investigations. So what I want to do right now is just go through some of the FTAGs. You have to remember, and the more that I do these cases, the more it becomes so abundantly clear to me that really any time I review a record, or maybe it's just because I'm so sensitive to the issue from being a legal nurse consultant, anything can be construed as neglect. Anything can be construed as or mistreatment. It's really the eye for knowing what to dig for and how to apply the regs that I think, again, takes that legal nurse consultant from a good one to a great one, because it is a complex field. So there's a couple regulations that I would point people to. And in the new FTAGs, the regulations that fall under abuse and neglect are the 600 level FTAGs. And FTAG 604, and FTAG stands for federal tag, and again, found in the watermelon book. And I say that jokingly, that's more of an internal phrase we use. FTAG 604 speaks to resident respect and dignity. And under that definition, it says that the resident has the right to be treated with respect and dignity, including the right to be free from physical or chemical restraint imposed for purposes of discipline, convenience, and are not required to treat the resident's medical symptoms consistent, that are consistent with, and then they cite a statute 483.12, which many of the statutes are based off of. I mention this because this regulation relates to the use of psychoactive medication. If you have a resident with behavioral manifestations, okay, and that person is considered a bully, or that person is considered aggressive, one of the last things you want to resort to is the use of mind-altering medications. You first want to peel back that onion and find out what were the triggers that caused this aggressive behavior to occur. I've been in some buildings that when I go in as a consultant, they feel zooey to me. And I'll tell people that this building just feels zooey. And when I get up on the floor, I see why. Because activities aren't occurring. Residents aren't engaged in doing things that are meaningful. Staff may be sitting behind the desks instead of out on the floors. There may not be enough staff. And those basic needs might be unmet, like keeping people cleaned, making sure that they're eating their meals in a safe and clean environment, and making sure that they have enough rest. Very much like the care of a small child. If you do that, those three things well, and they still have colicky, well, then you've got a different problem. And that's kind of the way I approach the way that I care for the elderly. So in this regulation, it the convenience of one of these drugs versus the discipline use of it. You have someone in a situation where they are either chemically restrained or physically restrained, and very, very innocent on behalf of the facility, like wheeling a resident underneath a table where they can't get out. That could be a caregiver that's just not as educated on it. And the next thing you know, you have an altercation when somebody throws a cup of ice water on another person. And I'm giving you real life examples that I've actually dealt with. So what you want to do again is understand what were the triggers. Sometimes it's the restraint. Some buildings, and I've been to a building where when I saw this, I loved the staff, but they had a cart. And they went down the hallway, and I actually thought the cart had like games and things for the residents to get engaged with. But what it had was an entire cart of different monitors to put on people. A chair monitor for her, a cushion for him, a bed alarm for her. And that particular unit, again, was a zooey environment. It took us about 30 days, but we did get those, what I would call, it is a form of a restraint now, eliminated, and started to figure out what could we do to engage people a little bit more. As part of the new regulations, the physician can order a mind-altering drug or psychoactive medication, and that would include anti-anxiety, anti-dementia, and a hypnotic medication. But they have to review it every 14 days. So my rule of thumb is, if you don't have to give it, then don't. If you're gonna give something, then give a one-time order of something and then reevaluate the person. That's only after you've met all their unmet needs, you've looked at behavior management approaches, you've separated the residents if there's an altercation between two people, you've moved the residents' room to a calmer place, you've done a million other things before you call the doctor up and say, we need a one-time order of such and such, Ativan or whatever.
All right. It sounds like a lot of factors to consider. And to think about, the easy solution is to sedate a person, but it's not the best solution from what I'm gathering from what you just shared.
Absolutely, because sedating a person now means that they're a higher fall risk.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of go in a circular fashion, kind of in the wrong way. You're going backwards instead of forwards, because then you're looking at, for example, if somebody is on Ativan and the doctor says, give them a shot of Ativan, well, then you better have somebody nearby that room watching them a lot, because if they try to get up and go to the bathroom and it's the first time they've ever had it, on top of that, they may have sensory problems. They could be in a new room that's not well lit. They could have a roommate that gets on their nerves. Imagine what a perfect recipe that is now for that person to fall.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, we've covered a lot of territory today, Gina, and I have a feeling that we could go on for another hour and not even touch the surface of this topic. Can you tell our listeners how they can find out more information about your company and the services that you offer?
Absolutely. So you can reach me on LinkedIn, and you can reach me. I'm an old AOL scout. I'm afraid if I switch from AOL, people won't be able to reach me. So my email is G for Gina, D for D'Angelo, which is my name, solutions, which is plural with the number one after it. So it's gdsolutions1@aol.com. I don't have a website up yet. I plan to do that down the road. And those are the best ways to reach me right now. I'm very responsive to people. I love what I do. I travel around the country. I learn so much from people in my field. And I will tell you that we have such great, great individuals that take care of the residents, mainly at the bedside. And I don't mean to say mainly, but the folks at the bedside are really, truly our heroes. And whatever we can do to support them, that's through education and staffing and teaching them what is abuse and going through nuances of it, the more we will build up confidence in our family members and in society and in general. Because many people really don't know abuse or neglect when they look at it. It's until somebody explains to them matted hair is a form of neglect, or two people yelling is a form of verbal abuse. Watch the way they react to each other. This isn't pleasant. It's only going to get worse, right? Also translating, and I'll just say this very quickly before we go, also translating this environment that we are blessed to work in to that of a school. When I teach abuse and neglect classes, I always say to the audience, if your child came home with a bite mark, if your child came home with a bruise, if your child's behavior changed in any way or their school marks, what would you do? Well, I'd be appalled. I'd go to the school. I'd do this and that. I said, okay, so take that emotion and apply it to our setting. And if everybody went to work every day and thought like that about the elderly, we would really be hitting the ball out of the park. So thank you for having me on today, Pat.
Well, thank you, Gina. This has been Gina D'Angelo and Pat Iyer talking about resident-on-resident altercation, and we've also touched on some other subjects as well. Gina, your passion for taking care of the elderly really comes through when you talk with us, and I appreciate that. We are all going to be in need of some type of services as we age, and we would really hope that the people taking care of us have that same passion.
Well, thank you, Pat.
And be sure, as you're listening to this program, to take advantage of our new mobile app, which is BizEdu, where you can download our podcasts. You can listen to our podcasts in the palm of your hand, as well as see our webinars, read our articles, take our courses, watch our videos, and get all your legal nurse consulting content in one place. We'll be back next week with a new interview, and thank you for listening. Be sure to order your copy of the transcript for the program called Reducing the Risks of Nursing Home Care. The link for that product is http://lnc.tips/nhc. Use the code LISTENED to get a 25% discount. You can also get the link for that product at the show notes on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. And please tell your LNC colleagues about Legal Nurse Podcast. I would love to reach more LNCs with our show.
And I've got a phenomenal resource for you just waiting on legalnursebusiness.com. My online training and books are designed to help LNCs discover ways to strengthen their skills and their businesses. Check them out at legalnursebusiness.com. Many of us are lifelong learners who enjoy the chance to keep expanding our knowledge, just like the Book of the Month clubs, my membership site, lnceu.com, gives you two online trainings every month. We have a yearly payment plan that saves you over $50 compared to paying monthly, and each program is hugely discounted. Look at the options at lncu.com. And my last website, the lncacademy.com, is the coaching program I offer to a select number of LNCs. You get my personal attention and mentorship so that you can excel and build a strong foundation for your LNC practice. Get all the details at lncacademy.com.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on iTunes. We always are interested in your ideas for new topics. Please leave a comment on legalnursepodcasts.com. Join our community and get notified of each new episode and receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on legalnursepodcasts.com. We appreciate you and your interest.